ba ba boo, ba 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 boo. If I could sing like Bing, how happy I would be.
Never in my life did I think I was going to record with Bing Crosby.
If I could sing like Bing, perhaps you'd go for me.
Can you imagine if you were rehearsing with Bing Crosby, what you'd expect it to be like?
Now everyone agrees that Bing is fun to hear. And if I don't do quite as well, just make believe he's near.
The introduction of electric recording technology in the 1920s had brought in a new era in popular music. Gone were the days when singers were required to bawl and shout into an acoustic horn. Now, in the softest of tones, they could be intimate, whispering their golden baritone sweet nothings right into the ear of the swooning listener. The age of the crooner had arrived.
Kiss me once, then kiss me twice, then kiss me once again. It's been a long, long time.
If you're going to put a label to crooning, it is the vocal featured style, solo male vocal with fairly large orchestra or a hot dance band, with a singer with not a tenor voice, but a light baritone voice.
It was the antithesis of shouting. It was a kind of singing that was made possible in a way by the carbon microphone. You no longer had to sing to the gallery the way Jolson did in that generation. And Crosby really figured that out. He figured out that the microphone was very good to baritones, that it captured the nuance of his lower range, which was quite lovely.
Bing Crosby's biographer, Gary Giddens, and before that, pianist and bandleader Keith Nichols.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze and listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Just turn me loose, let me
stay. Bing's professional career had really started in the 20s as one of the rhythm boys in Paul Whiteman's orchestra. Balancing and maintaining the softness of his voice against the resources of a full dance band couldn't have been achieved without the aid of a microphone. The lessons learnt in those early days stayed with Bing for the rest of his life. By the mid-40s, he'd turned his microphone technique into an art form, much to the astonishment of his 70s record producer, Ken Barnes.
I said, I've been looking at some of the photographs of you with the Andrews sisters. I see that you're standing on one side of the mic and the girls are on the other side. I said, did you record that way? He said, sure. I thought, my God, you know, you hear these records and the blend is so good, the balance is so good. And the band were in the same studio at the same time. I guess they were probably on maybe a single condenser mic or something.
I guess that goes back to the rhythm boys, doesn't it? I mean, those three guys absolutely balanced the enormous Paul Whiteman orchestra.
Yes. That's right, that's right.
This is sort of a lazy, drowsy, easygoing song about a fellow who hates work. All he wants to do is go fishing.
Well, is this song dedicated to you, Daddy?
No, I think Nick had you in mind when he wrote it.
Well, I don't object to going fishing as long as I don't have to walk uphill. That's all I'm out of it.
There you go. I told you this song was about you.
Well, I ain't lazy. I'm just blessed with a lack of ambition, that's all.
One of the most creative aspects of his extra musical talent was to create this persona that became so associated with him that a lot of his friends, people who worked with him, would say things like they can't tell where the public Bing and the private Bing begin and end, even though the public persona that he invented was that of someone who was lazy and sort of shiftless and didn't like to work, and you know, his socks didn't match and his shirt tails hung out, and he was always talking about he couldn't wait to the golf links, and but that was all part of the persona, because if you look at it objectively, he was, to use a more recent cliche, the hardest working man in show business. He made three movies a year during the 20-year contract with Paramount. A lot of contract players did that, but they didn't also make between 40 and 60 records every year, and they certainly didn't have a one-hour weekly live radio show as well.
I'll tell you why I can't find you. Every time I go out to your place, you gone fishing.
How do you know?
There's a sign upon your door. Gone fishing.
Oh, real gone,
Eddie. Real gone. You ain't working anymore.
Well, it could be, you know.
There's your hoe out in the sun. Where you left a row half done. You claim hoeing ain't no fun.
I can prove it, though.
You ain't got no ambition. Gone fishing.
I think one of my dad's greatest gifts, aside from his extraordinary musical and vocal talent, and acting, I might add, is that he was one of the most honest people that you could ever be around, so that when you saw him, that was who he was. He was a very simple, you know, he used to describe himself as just sort of an average Joe. And there was a great deal of truth to that. So that when people would watch him, it was very easy to identify with him because he was so incredibly honest, just like your brother or your dad.
Mary Crosby.
You wasn't tied up your dog. You just playing old gone fishing. There's a sign upon your door.
Well, don't blab it around, Pops. Keep it shady.
Gone fishing.
Got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got a piece of Gary.
But he seems to have been extraordinarily clever at sounding incredibly relaxed, even when he was tackling very, very difficult material.
That was just part of his gift. I think we were either doing the Urus on Broadway or the Palladium in England. Opening night, he hadn't been on stage in 20 years, and I was maybe 15, and I was nervous, so I went to his dressing room, and, you know, hoping for words of comfort. And he's sitting there drinking, like, a milkshake, which is, you know, you shudder to think of any singer drinking a milkshake before a show, and reading the newspaper. I looked at him, and I said, Dad, aren't you nervous? And he looked up and he said, nervous? What is there to be nervous about? So it really was who he was.
Oh, yeah.
My dad was so innovative. He had these great ideas. He was actually one of the original investors that brought the voice-on-tape technology over from Germany. I mean, that was his. Now, the reason he did that, of course, was a lot less altruistic than you think. He did it because he didn't want to tape a live radio show every day. He wanted to tape three or four and then go golfing. But the reality is he was actually responsible for doing that. So he really changed so much about the way business and the music business was able to function, because that opened up an entirely new world for so many people.
Magnetic recording tape technology had been developed by the Germans as part of their Second World War propaganda effort. Altruistic or not, Bing Crosby's investment of $50,000 in the Ampex Electronics Company was truly visionary, and it's possibly the most overlooked of Bing's achievements. Every singer from then on was able to capitalize on his investment. Al Martino, nearly a quarter of a century younger than Crosby, was one such beneficiary. An incredibly popular singer, he would have hit singles including Here in My Heart and Spanish Eyes, but breaking into a career, even a generation on, had a familiar ring to it.
You start singing in little cafes, and if they like you, you come back to sing another day. So you have to keep working and working from saloon to saloon until you get your break in New York. New York was the mecca of showbiz back in those days, not L.A.
But where do you go? How do you find the footholds that are going to get you on the ladder of success in New York?
Well, that's a very good question, because there was a landmark that was called the Brill Building. Brill, B-R-I-L-L.
That was publishing, was it?
Yes, it was a building with all publishers in it, and photographers, and vocal coaches, so many different things that can help you get your career going. and all the singers went there.
Now, one thing that I always associate with the stories of the Brill Building is the whole career of the song plugger and these guys who worked for the publishing companies going out and really selling songs to everybody. And I guess that was still going on at the time that you hit New York for the first time.
Yes, there was one gentleman by the name of Al Gallico. He had a pretty good hold on country music. He was in the Brill Building. And there was Barton Music, which is owned by Sinatra. And there was Southern Music, who actually made Dean Martin. They wrote a song called Return to Me. So somewhere along the line, some singer will get hooked up with a publisher like that, and he gets his first break. And I'll tell you something, the most fantastic thing is when you have a hit record and you wake up in the morning and there's a record shop just two blocks from the Brill Building. Outside of their record shop, they have a loudspeaker and they play the next number one record. And one morning I woke up and was walking down the street and I heard my record called Here in My Heart play. Then I knew I had a hit. So I couldn't believe it. I thought I was dreaming.
So lonely here in my heart, I just yearn for you only.
Here in my heart, I drove all the way from New York to Capitol to sell to myself as an artist. I mean, here I am, a Philadelphia boy, and I drove all the way. But while I was driving, though, I stopped at a lot of radio stations on the way to promote Here in My Heart, the record, and present them with a recording.
This is very much the way that plugging seemed to work in those days, wasn't it? You literally had a trunk full of records.
That's right. Today, it's not that way at all. We had a trunk full of records, and we dropped them off. And I stopped in any place where I saw an aerial. As a matter of fact, I even stopped at a police station, thinking it was a radio station. And they were pleased, though, to have me drop off a record anyway. Calling all cars, calling all cars. We have a record by Al Martino, Calling All Cars.
Never in my life did I think I was going to record with Bing Crosby. Never.
We'll have a blue room, a new room for two room, where every day's a holiday because you're married to me.
Buddy Bregman's a composer, arranger and producer whose list of credits reads like a who's who of popular music. In the mid-50s, he was a close friend of the Crosby family, in particular the children of Bing's first marriage. Bing's initial response when Bregman suggested they make an album together was that their styles were too far apart. Bregman was too young and too jazzy. He didn't give an outright refusal, however, and Bregman rushed off to find some music that he thought might tempt Bing into the studio.
By accident, I must tell you, I picked songs he had never recorded. Now, are there any songs Bing Crosby had never recorded? No, but there were. And I brought him over the next afternoon at 4, and I sat at the piano, played for him while he'd sing 8 bars, and he said, oh, that's good, and then put that aside. Then it's another that's good. And he said, oh, wow, why don't I consider it? It's an interesting thing. I didn't realize that it would be so comfortable. So they worked something out, the biggest deal ever made at that time, 10% of the gross from the first dollar and no payback. And I put a band together, I'll never forget, and he said, I have to record between 9 and 12 in the morning because my voice gets too high afterwards. So I said, oh, my gosh, these guys are, you know, all jazz musicians. So I'll never forget Maynard Ferguson crawling in at 8:30 in the morning. He said, what are we doing? I said, Bing Crosby. He said, oh, my God.
Holding hands at midnight, neath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, then you can get it if you try. Strolling with that one girl, sighing sigh after sigh. Nice work if you can get it, then you can get it if you try.
I've read lots of things that said that this was really the first time that Bing had recorded with, as it were, a modern big band. He'd made lots and lots of records with vintage swing orchestras of one kind or another, and then those rather sort of staid dance bands of the late 40s, early 50s. But it seems to me that you absolutely put him in the right kind of frame for the mid-50s.
And if you get it, where won't you tell me how?
There you were with Bing, and you've got this fantastic group of the top players in Los Angeles. How did you handle that? You're not that old at the time.
No.
Was it the confidence of youth? And how did Bing work in the studio with you?
He just said, tell me what to do. Tell me if you like the take. And if you like it, that's fine with me. I'll do a second take. I said, fine. So we started at, oh my God, 9 in the morning. And we were through at 11:30. 6 tracks for 2 days each. There's no one I've ever worked with any more professional, but he didn't rehearse. He said, oh yeah, I know that song. I laugh because I just had such a great time. It makes me well up a little bit. Terrific.
Nice work if you can get it. And if you get it, well, won't you tell me
By the 1960s, Bing's mainstream popularity was losing out, not just to the emerging rock and roll, which was picking up an audience young enough to be his grandchildren, but to younger crooners like Dean Martin and Perry Como, who were perfectly at home in the one entertainment medium that Bing never really conquered, television. Gary Giddens.
Como was a television phenomenon, which Bing never really was. I mean, Bing tried, a half-hour sitcom at the end of his career, which was a disaster. His specials did very well, but that's all they were, specials. Perry Como was on every week, and it was one of the highest-rated shows in the country for years and years and years, and every show, in a sense, was an advertisement for his latest album. And the same thing with Dean Martin, as soon as Dean had his own television show, his record sales started going up. You can't beat that for, an advertisement. Every week.
Bing never retired. His recording career may have slowed down a little as he approached his 70s, but that was only temporary. In 1976, he started a partnership with record producer Ken Barnes to make a series of albums in London.
Of course, you know that by the 70s, sessions were being run by and for the engineers. And the day before we did the first session, Bing wanted to run over the songs a bit, so we went into Chappell's studio, which is where we were going to record in Bond Street. And John Timperley, who was going to be the engineer for the sessions, he heard Bing was in the building, and I said, would you like to meet him? He said, yeah. So we took Bing into the studio, and John said, this is the studio we're going to be working in tomorrow. We're going to put the strings over there, we're going to put the brass here, the reeds there, the rhythm section will be there, sectioned off, we'll section off the drums. And you, Mr. Crosby, will be in that vocal booth in the corner. And Bing looked at the vocal booth and he said, mm-mm, no way. No, John, he said, that's no good. He says, I'm an old band singer. He says, put me with the band. He said, you're going to put me in that goldfish bowl over there. He says, I might as well have stayed in California and sung to a track. And John got a little worried, and he said, but Mr. Crosby, the brass can get awfully loud. And Bing said, well, I'll get louder. And he said, trust me, John, if it worked 50 years ago, it'll work today. And John said to me afterwards, he says, he was right to do it that way. And he said, there's only been a couple of singers that I've ever worked with, he says, that could do that. And Tony Bennett was one of them. We couldn't do it with Tom Jones, and we couldn't do it with Shirley Bassey.
I've sung about the birds and bees, the daffodillies and the shady trees. I've covered Mother Nature inside out. There's the old ox road, the old mill stream, pennies from heaven and darn that dream. Nothing that I haven't sung about.
Can you imagine if you were rehearsing with Bing Crosby, what you'd expect it to be like, and that's what it was like.
Keith Nichols was Bing's rehearsal pianist for that London session.
He was lovely to me. He said, "Well, I guess I'm going to have to rehearse with Keith here." And I said, "He's my name."
Can Keith stay and rehearse a verse with me, or what? Can you play him?
When he showed up, we did 3 days in the studio with him. He came in and he was delightful. My job was to rehearse the verses with him. There was no sign of wanting to get on. There was no fussiness.
When are you rehearsing the verses, Keith? I mean, verses are another issue with singers. Lots of singers are great on the chorus, but the verse is something to be got through quickly and disposed of. But you get the feeling with Bing that he treasured those words as much as the rest of the song.
He may have had a say in whether we did the verses, you know. One of the tunes was Old Fashioned Love, James P. Johnson. It was my job to take him through the verses, and he said, "Oh yes, I know this Old Fashioned Love," and he went... He sang the whole thing, but it was not Old-Fashioned Love. It was the verse of Baby Won't You Please Come Home, you see. So it shows that he did love verses, and he was very good to rehearse with.
I don't think I've ever worked with any singer who shaped up faster than Bing. He shaped up as fast as the band. He would never have heard the arrangement before, but he knew the song. And most of the stuff we did was done in, I guess, 2 takes. If I wanted a 3rd take, I had to give him a damn good reason.
Kiss today goodbye. The sweetness and the sorrow. We did what we had to do. And I can't regret what I did for love, what I did for love. Look, my eyes are dry.
I'd been a big fan of Sinatra. I'd always loved Bing, but I was a big fan of Sinatra and his attention to lyrics and everything. And Bing did a Cole Porter song, which he selected, called Looking at You. I thought it was good, but I didn't think he was into the lyric. You know, it wasn't a very passionate reading of the lyric. And I had the temerity to say to him the following day, "If you wouldn't mind, I'd like you to sing Looking at You again." He said, "Well, I'll do another one if it's necessary." So we played the track, and he said, "Well, it's in tune. My phrasing isn't too bad. Hear all the words." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I don't know what else I can do." He says, "I know what you wanted, a little more passion, eh?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Ken, the name's Crosby, not Sinatra. The fans will be fine with that."
Kiss today goodbye.
Sinatra really took the interpretation of lyrics to another level. People don't hear that kind of depth of feeling in Crosby after they've been exposed to Sinatra. You know, I find that when I go back to the early Sinatra, Crosby recordings, his interpretation of lyrics is just, you know, spellbinding at times. I mean, one of the records that I played for people when I was lecturing on Crosby is Home on the Range, a song that became a terrible cliche in the United States. After FDR, President Roosevelt said that it was his favorite song, bands played it everywhere he appeared until he just hated it. I mean, he had people, frontmen, running around saying, "Please don't all play Home on the Range for the president." And, you know, every American knows this tune. And when you listen to Crosby sing it, for the first time, for me anyway, suddenly I started thinking about those lyrics and what it's talking about and this, the whole frontier experience. And there's a darkness to it. When he sings songs like Mexicali Rose, there's a tremendous, I don't know, loneliness and a dark undercurrent and almost a fearsome quality that he brings to those songs.
Where the deer and the antelope play, where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies on a cloudy old day.
As we've heard over the last two programmes, the story of crooning neither began, or indeed ended, with Bing Crosby. Of course, there were other singers, great singers, Frank Sinatra, Perry Como, Dean Martin, Tony Bennett, and many more, who were and are hugely popular. But would they have achieved any of it without the genius of Bing Crosby?
Learn to croon if you want to win your heart's desire. Sweet melodies of love inspire romance. Just
people today, they're very impressed with the statistics, you know, how many hits he had, and more than the Beatles, and more than, you know, the hell with that. I wish that those people would go back and actually listen to some of the recordings. I think they'll be very surprised at how much he continues to communicate.
You'll eliminate each rival soon if you're heading for a sunny honeymoon. Learn to groove.
He was an amazing performer, and I love to watch him perform. But far more importantly for me is that he was Dad. The little private moments we had, he was a great walker, and we would go on long walks together. Not too much was said. He would make up these little songs that were just for me and sing them, and they were always funny and witty and very, very personal. He used to sing a little song to Mom. All the kids would be in stitches, and it would be, "Oh, Katerina, oh, Katerina, to win my heart, you must be leaner. There's so much of you, two can love you, learn to swim, join the gym, eat Purina." You know, really ridiculous songs like that. My mother was a size 4 her entire life. You know, so he would really play, and we were fortunate enough to be able to play with him. So his contribution to the world is huge, but his contribution to me is what's most important, and it was even bigger.
Learn to groove. You'll eliminate each rival soon if you're heading for a sunny honeymoon. Learn to croon.